From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 384 for this February the 12th, 2012, for Sunday House Call. We're broadcasting live from News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. Looking forward to speaking with you. We are here till 5 p.m. And I wanted to review something that parents will likely be very interested in. This was just released. I found this on WebMD, and it was published on February the 12th. The Food and Drug Administration, so this is the U.S. Now, whether this happens in Canada, likely, but we'll see what happens. But in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration has approved a no-comb treatment for head lice. Yes, I know it's not a topic people like to talk about, but it does cause a lot of consternation and anxiety in families and in schools when your child is told either they have lice or that they were exposed to another child who has head lice, and all the treatments that are required, the cleaning of clothes, the treatments for hair, the combing out of the nits or the eggs that are on the surface of the hair. And it becomes a relatively major ordeal considering that even with treatment, the problem is reinfection or reinfestation, to be more accurate. They go back to school. Very rarely is there 100% compliance with treating children concomitantly or at the same time. And as a result, the child gets reinfested and the whole process starts all over again. Well, the Food and Drug Administration approved a compound called ivermectin. Ivermectin has been used for 20 years as a pill form and treated billions. There have been billions of doses over the past, actually a billion people over 20 years treated for parasitic infections. This is a topical agent, so it's used on the skin, containing a 0.5% solution of ivermectin, and it can be used in children as young as 6 months. So it's approved all the way down to infancy. And in clinical trials, a single home treatment got rid of head lice in about 3 out of 4 children. Fewer than 1% had negative side effects, which included pink eye, redness in the whites of the eyes. In other words, eye irritations, dry skin, and a burning sensation. So very safe to use. It's included in a compound that has olive oil and other compounds in there. The company that's producing this is Sanofi Pasteur in the U.S. And the product, although I don't like to use product names in general, it seems to be only one product that has this right now. So in the U.S., it is called Sklice. So Sklice is the product available in the next few months that they said in the U.S. So I thought that was just interesting in terms of the fact that this is a very common problem and parents do have some difficulty at times, especially with combing out the hair, especially if their child has a lot of thick hair. And in this case, you don't need to use a comb because this particular product will kill everything off and is, according to the FDA, a very safe treatment to be using. So just in case you're interested, again, it is approved in the U.S. Ivermectin, I-V-E-R-M-E-C-T-I-N is the actual compound, and it's included in the product called Sklice, S-K-L-I-C-E. So, turning from that to some very interesting news, Time Magazine, and published today, published actually February the 10th by Alice Park, who writes actually really good health articles for Time Magazine and Time Healthland, the webpage. This has to do with a particular cancer drug that they found reversed Alzheimer's disease in mice. Now, before we start saying let's use this drug in humans to reverse Alzheimer's, keep in mind that there have been a lot of other clinical trials, at least in mice, that have shown effectiveness at treating Alzheimer's that didn't work in human trials. There was one, there was a potential Alzheimer's vaccine that appeared to chew up the amyloid, or the protein that deposits in the nerve and causes the nerve damage, but it failed to do so in human patients. So there is a litany of these kind of trials where what works in mice doesn't work in humans. So the results of the studies should be met with some skepticism, but it's still interesting to give you some background about it, because it likely will lead to some human trials to see if it does work. And in this case, this was reported by Case Western scientists in Science, the journal Science. So instead of working at the end of the problem, that is trying to shut down the production of amyloid protein, they wanted to try and improve ways of eliminating the amyloid protein. Again, this is what gums up the work, so to speak. And we do have a protein in our bodies called ApoE, which does do that, but it's certainly obviously not effective when someone develops Alzheimer's disease. And they did find that there was a class of receptors on cells that helped engulf and remove amyloid from these particular areas. And the drug that actually did that is a cancer drug that's used to treat skin cancer called bexarotene, B-E-X-A-R-O-T-E-N-E. And so when they use this in mice, now remember, and always remember, this is a study in mice. The mice, within 24 hours of receiving this drug, showed a 25% drop in amyloid in their brain fluid. And after 2 weeks, there was a 75% decline in the sticky plaques that were formed by the amyloid. It restored the animal's normal behaviors. And after treatment, the mice could build a nest, identify a small, identify smell, and perform better in water maze tests that required them to remember how to find a submerged platform. So in effect, their cognitive function, so to speak, their memory was enhanced, or at least returned to normal. So Alzheimer's, though, is different in terms of the plaques between humans and mice. They don't get Alzheimer's the same way as humans do. There's no progressive worsening of the condition in mice when it happens, whereas in humans that is the case. So again, it's not clear whether this particular medication, bexarotene, will do that particular effect in humans, but it certainly gives people the knowledge that work is still ongoing with regards to trying to figure out the mechanisms for Alzheimer's and reverse the process. So it's encouraging. I want to see what happens in human trials, but we're still looking at years before we know whether this actually has a true benefit. But nevertheless, still very interesting. And I thought that might provide a little bit of hope for people, especially those that have family members who are at risk of Alzheimer's who have Alzheimer's disease. We're going to take a small break and come back with your calls. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 and Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Heading right back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Judy in Kempville.
Hi.
Hi.
I was talking to you a couple of weeks ago about my father. He's 82 years old, suddenly became very tired. And
yes.
Weak. Yeah. You remember it?
Yes, I do.
So I did take him into the doctor a couple of days after I talked to you.
Right.
I kind of remembered he did have a bladder infection 2 years ago when he had the same condition.
Right.
So the doctor put him on a sulfa drug and ran... ordered a whole bunch of blood work, urinalysis, and all that. My dad did seem to perk up a little bit from the sulfa drug, but he's not back. He wasn't back to normal.
Okay.
We were back to see the doctor on Friday for a checkup and got the results of the blood work.
Right.
everything seemed to be fairly good. His creatinine and iron levels were really slightly elevated, but just very, very slightly, nothing to be worried about.
Okay.
He said that's common in older people.
Right.
Everything else was really good. There was about 3.5 pages of blood work there.
Mm-hmm.
Urinalysis was clean. So the doctor is kind of suggesting that his serotonin levels might be depleted a bit.
Okay.
And he's suggesting, he has ordered another geriatric assessment. My dad had one last year and the year before.
Right.
But you know, it's not going to hurt to have another one.
Sure.
So he's put him on something called meclobemide.
Meclobemide.
Okay.
Yes.
150 milligrams once a day.
Right.
For 10 days and then up to twice a day.
Okay.
Now, the other thing I forgot to mention when I was talking before is my dad does complain after he eats that it takes a lot of energy to digest his food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he doesn't want to eat a lot. He's not eating very much, and he eats very, very healthy, by the way.
Right.
But that's one of his complaints. So with what the doctor was kind of telling me, the way the serotonin works, I'm wondering if that might be what's going on with him.
Well, what the doctor has implied is that he is depressed because meclobemide is an antidepressant.
Okay, he said he didn't like to use the word that word, but
but we got to use what it is.
Okay, is that
it's an antidepressant. Meclobemide is what's called the fancy term for the class of medication. It's called a reversible inhibitor of monoamine oxidase, or REMA, R-I-M-A. And it blocks an enzyme that is found in the space between where the nerves communicate. The enzyme is responsible for breaking down serotonin, because when one nerve communicates with another, you don't want, you know, once a signal goes through, you want the signal to go through and then stop. It's like an on-off switch. So you don't want that switch on all the time because it can overstimulate a nerve.
Okay.
Well, in this case, what tends to happen if someone is not making enough serotonin in their nerve cells, and there is a signal that goes through, there's not a lot of serotonin that gets released into the area between the nerves to carry that signal. And if you have that enzyme sitting there, it makes it even less likely for that signal to get through, and hence someone may feel more depressed in terms of how the brain overall functions. So what this medication does is it blocks that enzyme from breaking down serotonin, giving it a chance, that is the serotonin, a chance to actually get to the other side, to touch the other nerve, in order to continue that signal. So that's in a nutshell what your physician is thinking with regards to low levels. Certainly depression can cause the symptoms your dad has. I'm glad that all the blood tests that you mentioned were done. There might be a few others, depends on what, again, I'm not privy to what the tests were, but there may be some other things that need to be done that the geriatric assessment unit will be able to provide. But nevertheless, it's certainly a medication that is not going to work right away. It usually takes anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks before you see any benefit. And usually the things that you will see are a reversal of fatigue, increased appetite and such, if the diagnosis is correct. And that's ultimately what we need, is a good diagnosis, because if there isn't one, then it's difficult to know what treatment would be effective to help him.
Right. And that's what I'm kind of wondering, because, I mean, he doesn't seem depressed to me. I mean, he wants to do things. He wants to, he was telling my mom today, he wants to get outside, he doesn't have the energy or the, he just doesn't seem to be able to do it.
Now, was his testosterone level checked?
I don't know.
That's something to check and see. I mean, again, someone who is depressed is not going to want to really go out and do things.
No,
I remember speaking with you about this, and we were trying to figure out, you know, is there an element of depression? And from what you were describing, there wasn't much to suggest that, because he wants to do things. It's not as if he's lost interest in living or interest in the things that he likes to do.
Not at all. I mean, he's got events coming up that he wants to attend.
Yeah,
and
right.
He can't.
So that doesn't sound like someone that's depressed.
Okay.
So what can happen in older gentlemen as well is their testosterone levels can decrease, which is something very common to see.
Is that a blood test?
It's a blood test.
Okay.
The usual, there are two different blood tests that are done to check testosterone. One is called a free testosterone level, or just we call it free testosterone.
Okay. Okay.
And the other is called bioavailable testosterone. The first one, the free testosterone, ironically enough, doesn't cost anything to do.
Okay.
The bioavailable testosterone, there is a charge. The lab will charge you for doing that test.
Okay.
But usually free testosterones are a good first step to do. And if it's very low, that certainly can contribute to fatigue, and just not feeling overall well. And that, as I said, is very common in people, especially in men who get older. So
okay.
That is another thing. If that test wasn't done, I certainly would say there's certainly no reason not to do it. It might be very helpful in determining whether that's indeed a cause of his fatigue. So I'm not sure if that was included in that test, in those tests that were done. So
I will check on that.
Yeah. So that's the next step, I would say, is that if that hasn't been done, I would do that. It just doesn't strike me that from what you're describing, and again, your doctor may have more insight than I do on this because, he knows your dad. But it just strikes me from what you're describing that depression may not be the diagnosis.
Yeah, no, it's, as I said, he was afraid to use that word because he knew how I'd react to it.
Right.
Because I don't think he's depressed at all. But
yeah.
I was confused with this serotonin thing.
All right. Well, yeah, so the serotonin, I mean, there's different. The serotonin is what we call a neurotransmitter. It simply means that it's a chemical agent that the brain produces to release into the area between the space. So when nerves don't touch each other, in terms of how they communicate, there's a tiny space between them. And in that space is called a synapse. And in that synapse is where the serotonin will be released from one nerve to travel, literally to swim across it's like having a lake and swimming across the lake to go from one side to the other. Well, in this case, the serotonin swims from one side to the other in order to land on the other side and tell the other nerve, okay, I'm here, let's keep sending the message on. It's literally like sending a friend of yours, telling them a message, that's having them swim across the lake to tell someone else on the other side what the message is, and then that person on the other side runs down the hill to go tell the next person, and on it goes. And that's sort of what serotonin does, but you also need to have a means of stopping that signal, and that's what that medication does. The medication actually stops the breakdown of that swimmer. So in other words, you don't have a net trapping the swimmer before they get to the other side.
But it was my understanding that he had a low level of serotonin, so why would we want to stop it?
Well, you don't. What the medication does is it prevents that net from stopping it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it prevents the breakdown of that medication,
of
the serotonin. But there are other neurotransmitters as well. There's noradrenaline and dopamine. Those are other ones that are found in the brain as well that contribute the same way.
Okay, I will find out
about
this testosterone thing and... probably call you back.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye, Judy. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. And good afternoon to our friend Rick in Hindenburg. How are you?
Still
kicking?
Still hanging in there, yeah.
All right.
Anyway, I still have the same old problem because I don't have a doctor. I've spoken to you before.
Yes.
I don't know if you do remember, but
yes, I do.
I had a very severe reaction to Hyzaar.
Yes,
a while back, and then after that, they tried to get me on Diavan, which turns out to be the same thing.
Right.
And anyway, now my question is still in the same vein.
Okay.
Now I was recently prescribed a diuretic.
Yes.
And I bought a book, one of these prescription books.
You know, okay.
And so I looked it up, and prescribed was chlorothalidone.
Chlorothalidone.
Yeah.
Yes.
And 50 milligrams, actually 25 milligrams.
Okay.
And but anyway, I looked it up, and in the book, I looked under diuretics, thiazide, and it gives a list of generic names, and then it gives brand names.
Mm-hmm.
And don't I find in the brand names both Diavan and Hyzaar?
All right. Well, actually, Rick, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a sec because we just have to break for the news, and then we can straighten all this stuff out for you.
Okay.
Okay. Hang on just a sec. We will come back right after the break. Break is about, I'd say a few minutes, and then we'll be back in about 2-3 minutes after the news. You are listening to Sunday House Call on 580 CFRA. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and indeed we will be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And heading back to the phone lines, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to continue our conversation with Rick in Hintonburg. And Rick, you were saying you were given a diuretic, chlorthalidone. Yep. And the concern was that the original blood pressure medications that you were given that you had a reaction to, one was, you said, Diovan, and the other was...
Well, it was Hyzaar. But then after I had that bad reaction, yep, they then prescribed me with Diovan, and luckily the pharmacist wouldn't fill it.
Okay, now, the question I have is, granted, chlorthalidone is considered to be a thiazide diuretic, so normally what you have in, for example, the Hyzaar was hydrochlorothiazide. So a little bit different than chlorthalidone, but nevertheless, it's a combination of hydrochlorothiazide and what we call an ACE inhibitor. Now, the other one, the Micartis, was this Micartis plus or just Micartis? Or sorry, was this Diovan or?
It was Diovan, and okay. I don't know. That was some months ago, but in the book it says Diovan HCT.
That's correct. So there's a difference. There's Diovan, which is just the antihypertensive in itself, and then there is Diovan HCT, which would have the two medications, including the thiazide. So Diovan doesn't have a thiazide in it, whereas Diovan HCT does. So okay, the question becomes whether the reaction you had was to the thiazide component of the medication, or the in this case that you had Micartis is what we call an ARB medication, whether that was the component that you reacted to. So that's essentially the issue. So I think what needs to be determined is which of the two, because your concern is warranted in that you don't know of which one of the two that you reacted to. So you may have the same reaction to the chlorthalidone, but you may not have a reaction to the other component that was in the medication.
But how would I find that out?
That's a great question.
I mean, without ending up in the emergency room.
What was the reaction that you originally had?
Oh, it was bad. My eyes swole shut. My yep. nose, my throat, my tongue, the whole lower part of my jaw was all. It was tingly.
Okay.
My tongue was swollen, and I just didn't know enough to go to the hospital. I was just being stupid because it never happened before.
Right, so that's a pretty severe allergic reaction.
Well, yeah, the doctor said after when I went back to the clinic, they said, well, you know, it could have been the final reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So ultimately, what I would suggest then is you would need a completely different class of blood pressure medication, something that was not in the class of Diovan or in the class of a thiazide, because right now you don't know which of the two are responsible. Mm. And likely only one is, and that's the shame of it. But given the reaction you had, it's not reasonable to ask you to try this, even the chlorthalidone right now, without actually knowing which one was responsible, because you're absolutely correct. You may have the same reaction again, you may not. It's a 50-50 chance.
Yeah.
I don't want a 50-50 chance.
No, not so, good odds.
Especially when there are other types of antihypertensive medications that will be effective for you and are not in those same classes. So at least you know that that one is not anything that has been registered as having an allergic response, and it's unlikely for you to have multiple allergic responses to the different classes of medications. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, because I would have to go back to the clinic to see another doctor, and the thing is, how would I approach that with the doctor? That I've told them of my reaction before,
yeah.
But they keep prescribing these things, and the thing is, it's very seldom the same person.
Yeah, that's the problem. Is there's no continuity of care. Ultimately, what you want to say to them is that the medication I was given contained both thiazide and, in this case, just mentioned it was Cozaar that you had. So Hyzaar. So you had the combination medication. You see, because we don't know in that combination what was responsible, I want to try something completely outside of those two classes of medications for my blood pressure.
Okay.
That's ultimately the message that has to go to the physician when you speak to them. Now, okay. I just want to check one thing here, because the other answer may be on the basis of, let me just look this up. I want to see which class Cozaar is, because Losartan. Yeah, so it is a... It is class of medication. There goes our angiotensin receptor blocker. Yeah, so it is the same thing as the Diovan that they were planning to give you. So I would say, yeah, you want to stay away from. I'll give you the fancy term to use, because that way it'll be a lot easier. So again, thiazide diuretic. You already know that one.
Yeah.
And the other one is called an ARB.
ARB.
Yeah, it stands for angiotensin receptor blocker.
Okay.
And that's the class of medication that was combined with the diuretic that you took. And because we don't know which one you were reacting to, you need something outside of the ARBs and the thiazides. So the different ones that you can try in terms of classes.
Yeah.
One of them is called a calcium channel blocker.
Calcium channel blocker.
Yeah, so they're called CCB for short.
Okay, I'm just writing here.
Yeah, that's fine. The other ones that you can take are beta blockers.
Beta blockers.
Yeah. So those are two others in terms of blood pressure medications that you can take, and I would start from there, because that at least you won't have, we have no evidence that you're allergic to those, whereas we have evidence that you're potentially allergic to one of the two in terms of the ARB and the thiazide.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
There was one other quick question. I've been taking for a few years now Fosamax.
Yes.
I recently heard something on the on TV that they've determined that if you've been taking it for more years, it's detrimental rather than beneficial.
Yeah, there are some side effects associated with use of usually more than 5 years. And ultimately for Fosamax, which is used to treat osteoporosis, 5 years of treatment usually means you could stop and be off of it for a little while and still have the benefit of having been on it. So it's something that carries forward even after you stop. So so you're absolutely correct that after 5 years of use, usually you want to see what the bone density is and give someone a break. Not a break in terms of bones, but give someone a break or a holiday from taking the medication.
All right. Okay, so I can,
you got to speak to someone first.
I'll speak to the doctor and arrange a scan or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, Rick.
Okay, and thanks a lot for all your help.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now. And we are going to go to line 4 and welcome Norma from Ottawa.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Dworkin.
Oh, you're welcome.
And would you kindly repeat, I just caught the end of it, when you mentioned regarding a toe fungus.
Yes.
Penlac. I've been prescribed Penlac, and I still have fungus.
Yeah.
Small toe. Now, did you say that Penlac doesn't really work?
It's only about 15% effective over a year.
Oh, I see.
And the reason is that toenail fungus. The nail, if you think of a toenail or any of our nails as thin sheets packed, stacked on top of each other. So it's like taking five thin bed sheets and just lying them one on top of each other. And in between the sheets is where the fungus will go. So if you're putting something on top of a sheet to try and kill off the fungus, you may kill it off on the top sheet, but you've got five other sheets underneath that have stuff stuck in between them that it's not going to reach. And so that's why the Penlac tends not to be overly effective over the course of a year, because the fungus has penetrated into the different levels of the nail.
I see. Is there another product that would help get rid of the fungus, please?
Yeah, there is. It's very expensive. It's not covered by the Ontario Drug Benefit Plan. It is covered by private insurance, but it costs about $350 to treat. The medication is called Sporinox. Itraconazole, I think, is the generic term for it. Sporinox is an antifungal agent. It's taken by mouth. It is taken for 1 week, twice a day for 1 week, but it's three pulses. That is, the first month, the first week of the month, you take it for a week, then you wait till the next month. The first week of the following month, you take it again for a week, and then again for the third month. So it's 3 months of treatment the first week of each month that you use this medication. And the reason you take three doses like that is it pulses through and gets deposited into the nail and creates literally waves. So for the first month, you take it for the first week. The nail grows a little bit so that whatever is deposited in the nail has now moved forward, literally, physically within the nail. You take the next dose, that sets up another wave or another line in the nail, and then again for the third month. And so as the nail grows out, the fungus, even if it gets through the first wave, has to deal with two other waves coming through of medication deposited into the nail, and that should help eliminate the fungal infection. But it is something that, as I said, is very expensive, and you have to take into account any other medication somebody may be taking to make sure it causes no harm. But it's called itraconazole or Sporinox.
Okay, and the first word I wrote down, Sporinox.
Yeah.
What was the first word, please?
You can use the word Sporinox. That's fine. Your physician
thank
will know
you.
That.
And all right, and would there be allergies to that?
As with any medication, that's potentially so, but nevertheless, very rare to see allergies with Sporinox.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Norma. All the best.
Thanks very much again.
And we'll take a small break and come back. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And back to the phone lines. And line two. Let's get line two up here. And Jean in the PN, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor.
Hi.
Hi, I have blood results from the emergency department. My own doctor never seems to call me for anything concerning blood results, but
okay.
I want to know, my sodium is 128 and the normal is 136
mm-hmm.
over 145. The chlorCl is 91,
mm-hmm.
the normal is 98 to 107. And I'm high in the MCHC 356 when the normal is 315 to 355.
Mm-hmm.
And lipase is 71 as opposed to 73.
Right. So the lipase is that's within lab error. What concerns me is your sodium is actually quite low.
Yeah. My son's is 131 and he's in his last 40s.
Yeah.
Goes on with us.
Now, are you taking any water pills or anything like that for blood pressure?
Coversil and indapamide.
Yeah, so indapamide is a diuretic, and that could cause sodium loss. 128, are you having any twitches or tremors or anything? Are you feeling off at all? Or
just depression. I have a goiter.
Mm-hmm. Because at 128, I got to tell you, with a sodium level of 128, we usually have people in hospital to try and bring their sodium levels back up.
Yeah, and what about my son with 131?
Yeah, 131 is still not so bad. It's when it gets down to under 130, especially somebody that's taking diuretic medication, that can cause a problem. It's likely something that has reduced slowly over time because...
Yes. So it was 135 in 05, and they gave me a printout of 05 blood.
You know what? I would certainly speak to your physician tomorrow if you can, especially with a sodium level of 128, and say, look, it's not good for me to have a sodium level of 128. We have to look at the medications and see if reversing that will help reverse my sodium level, because you can't really go down anymore. It really would be harmful for you.
Well, what am I supposed to do? He never seems to call me on anything concerning blood results, and I get physicals, and never. The Civic Hospital did it.
Well, what I would suggest is, if anything, if they're not answering calls, then I would go down to the office directly and just say, look, I have this sodium level of 128. What are we going to do about it? You know, it has to be acted upon, Gene. It's not something that you can just rest on with 128. And, you know, going to the emergency room with 128, I don't know if they're going to do much for you right now because you're not having any symptoms. But as I said, it's not good to have that level to begin with.
Oh, I'm drive a car.
Yeah.
And,
so I would say tomorrow if they're...
Well, they told me to go in tomorrow after 1 sometime.
All right, so that's good. So go on in, take those results with you and say, look, we got to get this sodium level back up over 130 to 132, 133 at least.
And how do you advise doing that? Because he never seems to...
Usually it would mean stopping the diuretic and monitoring your blood level every few days to check sodium levels. It would also mean monitoring your blood pressure, because we don't want your blood pressure to automatically spike up because a diuretic was stopped. So you may have to change that particular diuretic with another medication for blood pressure to try and prevent any major swing in your blood pressure. But it does mean blood tests to monitor your sodium level. And the sodium and chloride will likely go up hand in hand once you stop the diuretic. But I wouldn't stop that right now. The reason is that you could spike your blood pressure, and that could cause a problem as well.
So, it did drop my blood pressure.
Right.
He lowered the dosage of the Coversil from 8 to 4.
Right. So I would, you know, again, if you're going in tomorrow, the main thing is, how do we fix the sodium? And it likely is changing the medications. It's hopefully keeping you out of hospital. The last thing you want to go to is the hospital.
Well, I'm all alone. Yeah. I'm afraid I'll be all alone here.
Right. But if you're going tomorrow, that would be the thing to talk about, is how are we going to change these medications and how are we going to monitor my sodium level to make sure that it goes up into the 130s again.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I can tell you, Gene. I mean, that's really what has to happen.
Okay. Does this cause goiter too? Low sodium?
No, low sodium doesn't cause goiter. Goiter is usually caused by thyroid problems, usually.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's not the same thing.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Gene. Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to line 7 and welcome Stu from North Prescott.
Oh, good day, Doctor.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, kikimsa.
Okay.
I'm supposed to get a carpal tunnel operation one of these days.
Yes.
And I come across something called Graston technique, which effectively breaks down scar tissue and reduces inflammation that causes pain and restriction of mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you knew anything about it.
Well, I don't think it's going to really help the carpal tunnel. And the reason is that there is a band of tissue, and it's a fibrous tissue that's called the flexor retinaculum. It is a band that runs from one side of your wrist to the other and holds the tendons in place.
Mm-hmm.
And the nerve literally gets trapped between the tendons and that tissue, the flexor retinaculum, and it squashes the nerve. So you really can't break. It's not really scar tissue that's going on there. It's usually inflammatory processes, usually from using the hands a lot, that tends to cause that flexor retinaculum to swell up. And it's not something that by externally manipulating you're going to change. In fact, you probably make carpal tunnel worse by pressing on that area or trying to break down scar tissue.
I see.
So what the surgery does is it literally just opens up that flexor retinaculum. It's called a release because it releases the nerve from being compressed.
I see.
And thereby relieving the physical pressure that's occurring on that nerve. That being said, it still can take months after the surgery to get back to normal because the nerve has been compressed for a while. And it does take the nerve time to regenerate and repair itself. And it usually does, but it does take that amount of time. So even after the surgery, you may find, you know, I'm still getting the numbness. It still may be waking me up at night. I still have to shake my hand because it's getting numb. I'm getting the tingling in my fingers. That over time will gradually subside after the surgery.
I see. Well, this having scar tissue around that band that goes over the various nerves, if it was the scar tissue was taken away on the outside, at least on the edge of the band, would that not?
It's unlikely because the nerve is in the middle,
right,
and
the
tissue runs over across the top.
Yeah.
So again, it's the pressure being generated on the nerve. So it's not necessarily the thickness of the flexor retinaculum. It's the actual physical damage that has occurred over years that has led to that. So the danger of not treating it, especially if you're at the point where surgery is required, is that continued pressure on that nerve can cause wasting of the muscles around the thumb.
I see.
And when that happens, even if you get the surgery, you have a thumb that no longer works.
I see.
And so that's why you don't want you end up what's called an ape hand, where your thumb actually sticks to the side of your hand and you can't draw it across the surface and you lose that gripping effect.
I see.
So that's why if surgery needs to be done, I would say go right ahead and do that because you want to preserve hand function.
Yes, I see. Well, that's fine. And thank you very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome,
Stu. I guess pressing on that on a nerve with this, these are some sort of tools they use. It would make it worse.
That's exactly right.
All right.
All the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. My thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call. And your calls, as always, terrific. And we will be back again next week with another edition. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.